Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. School counselors nationwide say they're in damage control mode after the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why was released about a month ago. In case you haven't heard, the show is about a teenage girl named Hannah who has all sorts of terrible experiences in high school, including bullying and sexual assault. And so she decides to take her own life, which, by the way, Netflix chose to graphically portray in the last episode. 13 Reasons Why has been widely criticized by those who work in mental health and with young people. In fact, many experts say 13 Reasons is so off base, it would be more useful as a lesson on how not to portray teen suicide. Still, the show has sparked a conversation about the issue and the right way to approach it, and that's the conversation we're jumping into today in The Exchange. So let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests. Dr. Kimberly Lessard is here, school psychologist for the Pelham School District. And Kimberly, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Katie Eng. She just graduated with honors from Syracuse University. Katie made a suicide attempt just before her freshman year of high school. She's here to talk about what happens when you get the resources you need. And Katie, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Sharon Eng. She's Katie's mom. Following Katie's attempt, she became a Connect trainer and speaks to groups about youth suicide prevention. And Sharon, really nice to have you too. Thank you so much.
Thanks. We're excited to be here today.
Well, Kimberly, we're not going to spend the whole hour talking about this series, but how do you feel about it, given your position working with teens? From what I understand, everybody in your position is talking about this.
Right. I think that there are many things to be concerned about based on the show. Just the portrayal in terms of suicide, the things that lead up to a teen's attempt or dying by suicide, and also just the message that it sends around not being able to kind of access the supports that you need. And that was pretty concerning, that there was no kind of discussion around all of the supports that are available to teens and the help that they can get that is available for them.
You know, I've got a stack of articles on this thing. I mean, there's been so much written, Kimberly, and universally people in your position really seem to hate this thing.
We do. We do. It just does not send a message of hope or positivity or that there can be happiness in life.
And the school counselor in this is portrayed pretty poorly, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But just day by day, Kimberly, how has this affected your job at the Pelham School District?
There's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of kids talking about it. Even as I sit in my office working and with my door open, and there's, you know, students outside of there, you can hear them talking about the show and watching it. I think as a school district, we've really tried to respond by getting the information out to parents about it. We are using social media to try to send out the message of make sure that you're talking to your kids about this. Whether you choose to allow them to watch it or not, make sure that you're having the conversation around it.
So at least ask, are you watching?
Absolutely.
If so, what do you think? And so forth. What do you hear, that sort of chatter in the hallways? What do you hear the kids saying about this?
I think kids are captivated by it. And, you know, it's a kind of a drama, and there's some mystery to it, and it's something that kids enjoy because of that. I certainly think that they also are trying to make some connections between their own experiences in high school and what's happening to them and what's going on in the show. And so those are where some of the concerns come into play, is that it just really is not a good portrayal of, you know, the circumstances that end up resulting in suicide attempts.
Well, and as we said earlier, mental health professionals like yourself have a lot of problems with this. But what's your biggest problem, Kimberly?
My biggest problem is that there's kind of no sense of hope with the show. You know, this is, there's no sense of what are the resources that were available to her. There's kind of this graphic portrayal and almost romanticizing of the suicide attempt in and of itself, which was just, it was really concerning because that's not the message that we want to be sending to teens.
Well, let's bring our other guests in. There's a lot to unpack here. And Katie, this probably isn't easy for you to talk about, so I really, really appreciate you being with us. When did you start thinking suicidal thoughts, Katie? And what sort of made you feel that way?
You know, unlike in the series or in the book, I can't pin it down to 13 reasons, which I think is very common. I personally find that the series is most lacking in its exclusion of discussion of mental illnesses and their contribution to suicidal ideation or suicidal actions. So I can't really pinpoint a moment, but I know personally I began to feel what I now can identify as depression as early as seventh grade. And from that point, it kind of just blurs together. But I know speaking to a lot of my fellow students and friends, it's not an uncommon feeling for kids that age.
You know, I really appreciate what you said about the series 13 Reasons Why kind of points to, you know, this person wronged me and this person wronged me. And sometimes it's a big wrong, you know, sexual assault. Sometimes it's a, you know, a fight between friends or something. But you're right. From what I have learned over my many years of talking about this issue, so often depression is involved. And the series doesn't really address that, does it, Kimberly? It's just like, here's these 13 reasons, and, you know, you were all mean to me, so this is what I'm going to do.
It really doesn't. And
it's very shallow.
It is. And I think when we look at, you know, kind of the research around suicide attempts, you know, about 90% of those who have attempted suicide have an underlying untreated mental health condition like depression.
90%.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Sharon, I have to talk to you about this, too, as the mom. And from what I understand, you read the book and just recently watched the series. So how did it affect you as Katie's mom?
Actually, Katie read the book. And the first time that she read it was when she was going through her depressive episodes. And when I was watching what she was doing very carefully, and I totally missed it. After we were going to be on this program, I binge-watched the series because it's not the kind of thing that I like to watch.
The whole thing?
I've watched the first 10 episodes,
okay.
So I haven't seen all of it. So some of the things that I saw is it does seem like it's a normal kind of high school relationships. But things that are disturbing are if you look at Hannah's point of view and the way that the flashbacks work, it plays into a teenage idea of the revenge. And if you take your own life, you don't get to watch what happens afterwards. So it allows kids to think that I'm going to get back at all these people who have wronged me. In the series, the kids who have wronged Hannah are all in leadership positions in the high school. And their big thing is about not talking about it, which is the absolutely worst thing that you can do. If you see a problem, you have to say it. When something happens that is wrong, you have to stand up for yourself. You have to identify it. If you let bad things and wrong things consistently happen, they become normalized. And you don't want to normalize bad behavior. You want to normalize what's good.
So that's a plus about this series then, that it sort of highlights this culture of, you know, don't ask, don't tell.
What's positive is that it makes parents who are involved with their children have a great opportunity to discuss why it's the wrong thing to do not to talk. The best way to keep your children safe is to make sure that you've got a lot of protective measures around them. You want to have close relationships with your children. As kids go through adolescence, it's not always possible for the parents to have the closest relations. but you have to build a community of strength around them. And you have to know that as a parent, where to pull those community resources from.
What do you think about that, Katie? Your mom's absolutely right. When you're a teenager, it is hard sometimes to be close to your parents. They're the last people you want to be with. What community of strength was around you that helped you through this?
Well, prior to my attempt, I didn't think I had much of a community, but part of the recovery process was building my safety plan in order to have or ensure that I had people or places to turn to if I felt I was in trouble or if I didn't feel mentally sound. So part of that was, I guess, improving my trust in my parents. And since then, my mom has become one of my pillars for my mental health all through college. I called her whenever I had, you know, just needed a moment to take a mental rant and get that out of my chest. But also, it took a lot of looking at myself and self-reflection to figure out what can I do as productive coping mechanisms and how can I grow and change my own cognitions and behaviors to make sure that I stay safe for my own sake.
Who helped you through that? What other figures?
So I had a fantastic therapist. My mom soon got me into seeing both a psychologist and a psychiatrist. And he was actually the second one I went to. So it's not a perfect match all the time. But when you find a mental health professional who you match with and who you feel comfortable with, it makes a world of difference. And I don't remember how long I saw him, but I went to him weekly. And through our sessions, I just learned so much about how to cope with my own mental illnesses.
I want to invite our listeners to join us. And then there's so much more to talk about. The number for you to be part of our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, how to talk about teen suicide and how not to talk about it, as the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why is widely criticized by those who work in mental health and with young people. But as we're hearing, the show has opened up a conversation about how this subject is portrayed, and that's what we're looking at today. We'd love to hear from you. Your stories, questions, comments, concerns are, of course, welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, I want to pick up on something Sharon said earlier. One of the biggest problems, Sharon, that you said you have with this series and that a lot of the professionals also have with this is, as you said, Sharon, it's shown as Hannah's way to get revenge on all those people who've been horrible to her. Again, she, you know, comes up with these 13 reasons and sort of blaming all these people and then creating an audio tape towards each of them. And this is why, you know, you made me so upset that I had to do this. It's a pretty disturbing concept, as you said, Sharon. Let's hear the character Hannah just set this up at the beginning of the series.
Hey, it's Hannah. Hannah Baker. Don't adjust your, you know, whatever device you're hearing this on. It's me. Live and in stereo. No return engagements. No encore. And this time, absolutely no requests. Get a snack. Settle in. Because I'm about to tell you the story of my life. More specifically, why my life ended.
Okay, again, that's a cut from 13 Reasons Why, the Netflix series about a girl's suicide. And how does that hit you, Kimberly, hearing that?
It's a pretty kind of powerful kind of entry way into the show. As Sharon mentioned, that we want to be really careful to make sure that people understand that when you take your own life, you're not there to then send those messages afterwards.
You're not the winner.
Right. You're not. So I guess I get a little bit concerned in terms of those pieces. But I do think that, as they kind of make this portrayal of there's a multiple of amount of reasons why people take their own life, and it's not just one factor. But again, you know, revenge often isn't the reason.
Yeah, she's sort of getting back at them and almost kind of enjoying it in that little clip, which is pretty creepy, forgetting that, again, as Sharon and you've pointed out, she's not the winner here.
Right.
You know, she may enjoy that fantasy of how bad they're going to feel. So for an adult, you know, it seems pretty rational and obvious. But what about the young brain, Kimberly? How does the young brain kind of process this idea of, you know, I'm so upset at them and they hurt me and now I'm going to hurt them back?
So, you know, the adolescent brain is a very imbalanced thing.
I've got two teenagers. I right. completely understand that. Yes.
And so the parts of the teenage brain that experience and feel emotions and store emotions and then also are involved in that impulse kind of piece are very well developed. But the parts of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, that are involved in impulse control and regulating emotions are not very well developed. So those emotions that teenagers are feeling are quite strong, but then they don't always have the ability to kind of regulate and control and make good decisions around those, which is why we tend to give a lot of external supports and help, and parents do provide a lot of supervision and overseeing and a lot of guidance around that time frame. So, you know, I think a lot of kids we see tend to really struggle with the intensity of their emotions around those adolescent time frames. And it's important for us to continue to work with them and help them learn those coping skills to regulate those during those times.
Let's take some calls, all of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Melinda's in Brookline. Hi, Melinda. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to reach out because, unfortunately, our community this week is facing a devastation, much like you're referring to on your show today. What is it that schools in this situation have done in moving forward to ensure the safety of the students, not just the safety?
Oh, Melinda, I'm so sorry. It sounds like we're losing your connection. And I wanted to ask her another question. It sounded like, Sharon, she was saying her community faced a devastation. I'm guessing that's a suicide.
The schools throughout New Hampshire have been changing their safety measures for students. And every school has a plan for how to deal with a tragic situation like this. And the first thing that you have to do is communicate the message. What happened? It's important to destigmatize suicide. You have to say that a child took their life, and then you have to work at developing the protective measures in the community to make sure that you prevent further action, because suicide is preventable. As we said before, 90% of people who make attempts have an underlying mental illness. Mental illness is treatable. So we build these protective factors into the school community. And the first thing is about being able to talk about your feelings, being able to talk about your concerns. And it also means making sure that lethality of means are removed from the environment.
Lethality of means meaning guns, pills,
ropes, knives. You have to think of all the ways that someone could harm themselves and minimize those risks.
What's the line, Sharon, between destigmatizing but not glorifying?
Well, destigmatizing means being able to say the word suicide. A lot of people have a difficult time saying it. It's being able to say to a child, do you feel like hurting yourself? I care about what you're thinking. I care about how you feel. You don't look like you're feeling very happy right now. What can I do to make you feel better?
We'll pick up on that after a short break. And you can join us as well. Thank you for that call, Melinda. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a very tough topic. What's the right way to talk about teen suicide and why so many mental health professionals say the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why gets it so wrong? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guest in the studio, Dr. Kimberly Lessard. She's the school psychologist for the Pelham School District, where she tells us a lot of kids are talking about this. Katie Eng is also with us. She just graduated with honors from Syracuse University. Katie made a suicide attempt just before her freshman year of high school, and she's with us to talk about what can happen when you get the resources you need. Sharon Eng is also here, Katie's mom. Following Katie's attempt, she became a Connect trainer and speaks to groups about suicide prevention. And Sharon, just before the break, we were talking about schools and the proper messaging and so forth. And I was asking you, you know, what's the difference between destigmatizing suicide and glorifying suicide, which is what people say about this series. And I wanted to just give you another opportunity to follow up there.
Okay, so some of the things that you see in the Netflix series is a memorialization of Hannah's locker. There's all kinds of flowers and messages put there. And Hannah's mother comes and says, these are from Hannah's friends. Anyone who was Hannah's friend would know she hated this stuff, right? So when you make a memorial to a person who's taken their life, you do a celebration of their life. You don't make it a grand production, because a grand production to an adolescent mind can be something that they want to emulate because they would want that same kind of attention. So that is
even though
wrong,
they're gone, which is just kind of,
well,
yeah.
That leads to the kind of suicide contagion, right? Because if someone's getting a lot of attention because this horrible thing happened in their community, it can plant the seed that other children or people may be seeking similar kind of attention, and that prefrontal cortex thing is still at work. The predictive skills aren't there. That the idea that this is a permanent condition isn't there, and so it can lead to further tragedy. At the school that Hannah went to in the series, immediately after her suicide, there are signs posted all over about suicide prevention. Well, that's a wrong time to do it. You do it before it happens, not after it happens.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned suicide contagion, because I have read, Kimberly, that some schools, and this is around the country, not just in New Hampshire, some schools are worried about suicide contagion after this series.
They are, and they should be. I mean, we know that one of the risk factors in terms of an individual then dying by suicide or attempting suicide is knowing somebody who has attempted suicide or died by suicide. There's this social modeling kind of piece that teenagers are very aware of, and they kind of emulate. Unfortunately, you know, teenagers are really, they've got a lot going on. And one of the things that they have going on is the search for identity. Who am I? And when you have teens that are particularly vulnerable, they look to their peer group. And so if they have a lot of social modeling going on that is kind of emulating suicide, then those are the things that they look at. So we do have to be very cautious about it. And I think that Sharon's absolutely right. One of the things that we need to be really mindful of as schools is prevention. And prevention, not after the fact, not as a reaction to a suicide or a suicide attempt, but embedding that into the school setting all of the time so that prevention work is occurring.
Well, and it's pretty creepy what you're saying, because, you know, one of the risk factors for, as you said, Kimberly, for suicide is knowing someone mm-hmm. who has died by suicide. teenagers could look at this series and feel like they know Hannah. Right. They get to know her pretty well. So even if there's no problem in their own particular community, you know, all you have to do is go on Netflix and there it is.
Right. And this is why I think it's so important for parents and for the supportive adults in kids' lives to be talking about this and to be talking about the message of hope, that there are resources out there, that if you are feeling bad or sad or like this is the only option, that there are places that you can go and that there are people that will work through these difficulties with you.
Katie, again, this happened to you when you were pretty young, entering high school. You said you started feeling depressed around seventh grade. Did you reach out to the school counselors at school, or did that just feel sort of off-putting and you didn't know them? And I'm just wondering what kind of a resource there was at your school.
I know there was a school counselor, and that teachers would often say, you know, if you're struggling with anything, like come by our office or anything. But part of depression and anxiety and a multitude of other mental illness is the guilt that's associated with it. And especially with in our society, the stigma around being mentally ill or having a mental illness where, you know, they say it's all in your head. Well, of course, it's all in my head. You're not producing the correct neurotransmitters. You don't have the chemicals to make you function normally. So there is a large part of that. And I just felt, you know, there's something wrong with me and I should be the one to fix it. But as I gained more support, I realized, no, this isn't a personality or character flaw. And it's something that there is help, and I did get help for it.
It sounds like you got great help through your mom and the counselors and so forth. Did people at school, did you feel like they judged you after this happened?
After my attempt, I'm actually not sure how many people knew what had happened. I'm sure there were rumors going around school because I did have to withdraw from school for medical purposes for a few months just to regain my equilibrium. So I'm actually not sure what kind of rumors were talked about, but I feel like people must have had some kind of idea. But for the most part, they either just avoided me and didn't talk about it, or they tried to be kind, which I really appreciated. I remember when I first returned to school,
It's okay, Katie. We've got plenty of time. Do you want your mom to fill in there and then we'll get back to you?
Sorry.
That's really okay.
When I first returned to school, just a girl who I'd never really talked to wrote on my Facebook wall that it was nice to see me back.
And yeah.
That really meant a lot to me.
Right. Well, and we keep getting back to this series. That's one of the things that they talk about, Sharon, is being kind.
Yes, and
before the fact.
the thing is, sometimes there are so many unkindnesses that we've built into, it's institutionalized. And one of the examples that I would use from the series is when Hannah's mother sees the bathrooms and there's all kinds of rude messages. And you know that in the school that the bathrooms are always monitored. And how is it that we let those kinds of messages stay on the wall? Because it was so under the radar that we didn't even notice. So that's one of those things about normalizing bad behavior again. You shouldn't be calling somebody names. You shouldn't be writing something on the wall, destroying public property. Those are wrong things. You need to fix those things and clean them up and make sure that everyone sees that that's a wrong thing to do.
Well, and with the advent of social media, it's so much easier to put out hateful messages to people. And in this instance, Katie, that's a good story that, you know, she put something kind on your Facebook wall. I want to ask you about that, Kimberly, in a moment, but let's go back to our listeners because they want to participate as well. Again, we welcome your questions, comments, personal stories, 1-800-892-6477. And Jory's calling from Maine. Hi, Jory, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for doing this show. I'm a mental health provider and have seen tremendous negative, dangerous effect in my clients from this show. I've had an increase in hospitalizations, suicidal ideation. And so I think it's so important that you're doing this show, and I really appreciate it. One of the things that I think that the show gets so wrong is that kids who suicide, suicide because they believe that nobody, part of it is that they believe that no one would miss them, that no one would care. So I think it's certainly in my experience as a mental health practitioner, it's extremely rare that somebody who thinks that their death or their life would matter so much to people that they could exact revenge from them is really not the student that's going to suicide. My suicidal and a lot of this is not, people don't become suicidal usually through circumstantial things. There's almost always an element of severe, chronic, ongoing depression that people just can't handle any longer.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that we talked about. And I think you talked about it, Katie, that, you know, to say here's 13 clear, concise reasons why, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, is a little bit oversimplified. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that too, Kimberly?
Well, I absolutely agree. And I think that some of, you know, what the caller was talking about was really this kind of sense of loneliness and that I don't have anybody. That's one of the key questions that we often ask when we get concerned about kids and whether or not they might engage in a suicide attempt is, who is it in your life that you can connect to? Who do you feel like really knows you best and you can talk to try to get a sense of, are those connections or are people really feeling like I don't have anybody?
Here's an email that came in from Jonathan who says, I'm the father of a 12-year-old. I became aware of the show because of my daughter. We watched the first show together. It was inappropriate for her. I watched it myself. I found it disturbing. However, he says, it opened up a conversation between my daughter and myself. I found out that 6 people in her school were cutting themselves. It gave me an opportunity to tell her that I want to talk about things she was facing, even if it's uncomfortable. One thing I learned from the show is that as parents, educators, or people that are around young people, we adults have to pay attention to them. We have to listen to what they say and why they are saying it. In the show, 2 of the main characters say, "My parents don't even look at me, and when they do, they don't see me. My daughter told me she often feels invisible. This is why the show gives us an opportunity to talk to each other." Jonathan, thank you for that email. And here's another one that came in. This is from Kevin in Conway. "Scary, isn't it?" he says. "Professionals, time to do your job. I've heard a lot of negativity about the program. However, it has opened up the conversation. According to my children and several others, they can't believe how well the show nails what life is like in high school nowadays. It seems to me it's just like the racial tension. It's out there and nobody wants to discuss it. Maybe it's time to start listening to our children and having discussions with them, as scary as that sounds." So thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Kevin. What do you think, Katie, about these comments that, you know, we spend a lot of time saying they didn't do this right, they didn't do this right, they didn't do this right. But these two dads say they start a conversation that I might not have had with my daughter or son otherwise.
Right. With anything, it's hard to say it's horrible in 100% of its aspects. So if this show does serve as a springboard to get us talking about suicide and mental illness and how to prevent them and the treatments available, then great. But I also think it's very risky for children who are watching this alone. I know there are plenty of times you have access to Netflix or just the internet in general, and parents might not be aware that this is what's accessible. So I think, again, it's talking within your families or within your community about what content is available to your children and making sure you have those conversations, even if they're uncomfortable.
I really want to thank those gentlemen for those emails. Go ahead, Sharon.
One of the things that we find missing from the series is it does create some great talking points. The thing is, there's a conversation that needs to go on afterwards, and that resource isn't always obvious. So there are a couple of resources that I could talk about. There's a national suicide prevention hotline that anybody can call, 1-800-273-TALK. That's 8255. For teens, there's a text line you can go to, 741-741. That may be a more comfortable place to go. And online, there's the connectprogram.org, which will also tell you where you can go in your community. People who are feeling sad need to be connected, but knowing where the resources are can be difficult. Well, so those are always there.
And I really appreciate that. And I've got those resources in front of me as well, and we'll put them on our website. So if you're driving down I-93, don't worry. We'll put them on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Back to our listeners. Debbie's calling from Connecticut. Hi, Debbie. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Yes, I live in Connecticut in a small town, and unfortunately, 9 years ago, we did suffer the loss of our daughter through suicide. And so I just wanted to say that the really tough thing for us was that we forced ourselves to watch this show because I actually came up with a presentation and a website that I'm now doing in her honor. And when it happened, there was total silence afterwards. This town did not react at all. It was as if it did not happen. And yet, after that series, the whole entire country and even people in the world, because I actually got an email from somebody in New Zealand, are now talking about it. Fast and Furiously, and all of these, you know, school personnel are sending out letters, and there's all kinds of discussion about it. And the discussion, I think, is great. The concerns are many, and it just really, you know, got to me that you actually had a real case here, and nobody paid any attention. And now you have this fictitious case that is romanticized and is sensationalized, and yet all eyes are now on that case. And I do think, you know, I'm glad that they are talking about it, but this show, I think, does do it somewhat in an irresponsible fashion. And I think it's important that kids who are watching it do know that. And I agree with a lot of the points that were brought up today concerning that.
And Debbie, I'm so sorry about your daughter. And I think I read about her in the Concord Monitor. Is that correct?
Yes. My brother-in-law. There and asked me to put that.
It's a beautiful piece. And
thank you
for sharing that with us. I also want to let you know that here in the Exchange, we've looked at youth suicide for a long, long time. So we're not looking at it for the first time now,
right.
for sure. But just tell us a little bit more about that silence after your daughter took her own life. Why do you think that was the case? And how, you know, how did you respond to that?
She was only 14 years old. She had just finished her last year in middle school in eighth grade. And, I mean, she was a very, very, she was a very bright child, and she was very introspective. And we adopted her from Russia when she was 3.5 years old, as she had been living in an orphanage. And she was remarkable considering the background that she had, because she had been taken from her mother at 18 months of age. Not as an infant. So it made a very big difference. She had been in different places before we actually got her. So there were a lot of issues just in her background. And then she had these three girls who she was very good friends with that just decided to dump her in eighth grade and were really, really cruel. So she had a lot of issues related to that, but she presented herself, you know, as a very confident, very happy, easygoing girl. So this, a lot of these signs were missed in the school. So and particularly teachers, they had absolutely no idea, so they wouldn't be able to step forward and help her. But, you know, we did see a change in her, and she was getting some help outside, but she was not ever totally honest in telling just how upset she was and how deeply she felt about the loss of the friendship. And I think what's very typical in teenagers is that those relationships were more important to her, and she judged herself by how those girls were judging her much more than by the way we as adults
right
judged
and
her.
That's typical. And Debbie, I want to thank you for calling and also let everybody know that we will put a link to your article. It was a beautiful piece, the article that your brother-in-law wrote, on our website. So thank you for sharing your story, and stay with us.
Ideas come naturally to writers.
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how to present the subject of teen suicide in families and in schools. What's the right way to talk about it? What's the wrong way? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Katie, Sharon, and Kimberly, just before the break, we heard from Debbie calling in from Connecticut, but an article about her daughter, Alexa, who took her own life, was in the Concord Monitor recently. And I wonder, all of you, but maybe you first, Kimberly, what Debbie's call brings up for you.
She made a really important point about the impact of schools. And so I know that I certainly would like to kind of talk about that at some point. But I also think the silence, the pain that she kind of talked about, that's concerning. And I think, as we've talked about, the need to destigmatize this, to talk about suicide, is incredibly important, not only in schools, but also in the community. And so I think New Hampshire is kind of doing a lot of work in that area. And so I think that's important to talk about, you know, in terms of getting the message out there regarding mental health, the campaign to change direction. I know in Manchester, there's billboards going all up, all over the city, kind of, you know, pointing and trying to raise awareness of the 5 signs, and to be looking for those in youth and in everyone, and how important that is. So I think raising awareness was something that really stuck out for me.
Well, go ahead a little bit more on schools.
Schools are changing, and I think that there's been a bigger push in terms of recognizing the need for addressing mental health needs within the school setting. The reality is that a lot of our teenagers don't have access to good mental health care. You know, 1 in 5 adolescents between the ages of 13 and 18 meet criteria for a diagnosable mental health condition within that time frame, and a large majority of those go without treatment. The large majority of mental health services are provided in school settings. And so I think as schools, we're trying to figure out, how do we adjust? Pelham School District in particular has done a lot of work, particularly this last year, around building a comprehensive school mental health system. We've been part of a grant where we're working with the University of Maryland School Mental Health Program in terms of building that and developing that. And there's about 3 school districts in New Hampshire that are kind of part of this grant. And so we've been able to work together. The Office of Student Wellness through the Department of Education is also really leveraging a lot of this work and doing a lot of work in this area. Our State Department of Education. Yeah. And they've been an excellent resource for us. And so some of the things that we've been doing is really looking at bringing in universal kind of comprehensive social-emotional learning programs so that all students are getting access to some sort of intervention and being taught coping skills and self-regulation skills and emotional regulation skills. We were able to bring in Challenge Day, which is a social-emotional learning program for our high school students, which has had a really amazing positive effect around school culture. In fact, a group of those kids said, we don't want it just to end after one day. We want to have a full club. And so they're meeting on a weekly basis with one of the adult participants and kind of leveraging that work and kind of trying to carry that forward. We've also made some really good connections with our local community mental health agency, the Center for Life Management, whereas right now they're actually sending one of their clinicians into 2 of our buildings 1 day a week so that they can provide services to students that otherwise couldn't access them.
Well, there's such a shortage of mental health professionals in New Hampshire, and from what I hear, even more so professionals who can deal with young people.
Right. There is. And so, you know, but there's a lot of positive work that's going on in schools. I think that there's still a lot of work to be done. But I think there's a lot of schools around this country that are also trying to kind of leverage this work and really recognizing the need that we need to be providing better services to students. And that begins not only at the school counselor and the school psychologist level, but also at the teacher level. So, you know, providing professional development to teachers in youth mental health first aid, in suicide prevention, that kind of work is kind of going on in different school districts. So I really encourage parents to reach out if they have concerns. Reach out to your school and say, what are you doing? Because I think you would be surprised that there's a lot going on.
Yeah. Do you want to jump in, Sharon? And then Katie, I have another question for you.
You know, Debbie's call brought up for me, you know, when no one reached out to her, that goes back to the kindness thing. If you have a loss, I'm sorry for your loss. And Debbie, you know, her life really mattered because we're talking about her life even now. When Katie made her attempt, okay, for me, I've always been a pretty high achievement oriented person academically, professionally. When I became a mom, I wanted to be Mary Poppins, practically perfect in every way. And when your child attempts to take their own life, there's nothing that tells you that you didn't succeed as a parent as that.
So you blamed yourself.
Well, of
Sharon.
Course you do. And then you think that everybody's judging you. Oh, she must be a terrible mother. What's going on in their house? They have to have a terrible family. And then you have to realize one of the best things that I learned through Katie's process of recovery was about how to deal with emotions. One of the mental health professionals explained it to us like this. When you start feeling emotions, you have a choice. That's actually your brain telling you that things are not working right in your life. And it's time to do something differently because things aren't working right. On the other hand, you can choose to jump into those emotions and just wallow in them and let them overtake your life. But things aren't going to change that way. So if you have a different perspective about how to deal with emotion, then you can say, oh, yeah, that's just my brain telling me it wasn't working. And so for me, then I could stop worrying. I don't care what anybody thinks about my job as a mother, how I've done with my children. All I know is that I have to take care of my children. And I am going to be the biggest, most persistent advocate that I can. And I'm going to make sure that my children do well. Because it's not about me, it's about them. And when I became a Connect trainer, that was when it really clicked for me.
Connect, again, is just
Connect
remind us.
Is a part of NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, is training regular people like me. I'm not a professional mental health person, but they trained me in how to work with the different communities to provide these protective and preventive measures to keep not just kids, to keep everybody safe in a community. So I work with schools. I do presentations for the community at the public library. I'll go anywhere that anybody asks me to talk about how to keep people safe. But when I did that training, that was when it was really freeing for me to know what happened to Katie was not about me. It's her thing.
And I'm going to help her, but it's not a reflection of me being,
it is,
you know,
not
Mary
on
Poppins
me.
Or not.
It's not my fault.
It's really hard. Katie, I have a different question for you. You mentioned earlier a great story about when you came back to school after several months being away. Someone wrote something nice on your Facebook wall, and that was just super important, the right message at the right time. I have heard also that the explosion of social media can sometimes be not helpful when it comes to someone who is depressed like you were, who is having suicidal thoughts like you did. And I just wonder what your thoughts are, Katie, about the pluses, like that story you told us, and the minuses of social media and people commenting on you, your looks, your behavior, what you said, what you did, all the time.
Right. I mean, I think it's unfortunate that so much of our self-esteem is rooted in the attention that we can get on social media. And the person we portray on, you know, Twitter, Facebook, whatever you use, isn't an accurate reflection of your life. I remember being in the worst parts of my depression and looking on Facebook and, you know, everyone's posting so many pictures with their friends and like all the exciting things they're doing and like scholarships or camps or whatever they're doing. And I kept thinking, like, that's never going to be me. Like, what's wrong with me that I can't have this? But then, especially as you grow older and you grow more comfortable talking about, you know, what's going on in your life and there's less social pressure to be perfect, you realize, no, of course, these people are going through so many things you never know. So I think it's important to remember that, and it's okay to not be perfect. I think that was one of the biggest takeaway messages that I got from my recovery. But also, I think social media is potentially so dangerous for so many young people who they use it as a method to lash out at others or to gang up on others.
And it's so easy.
Yeah. And preventing that is so hard because sometimes, you know, your friends will post a teasing comment. And how do you distinguish who are your friends who are doing it not maliciously versus some other people who might not have good intentions for your child or yourself? And being able to separate yourself from that and recognize that you need to take a step away from social media sometimes is really hard because everyone's there. That's how you connect with people. So I don't know if it's the job of parents to constantly watch and monitor what their children are doing, because that's just not possible. But I think the earlier we can have these conversations, the better. I think even starting in middle school, it would be a good idea to start talking to your kids about, you know, puberty is coming and so many changes will come with it. But here's what you can expect, and here's what it might look like if you are not going, or these feelings aren't expected and you should talk to someone about them.
This isn't a normal teenage feeling.
Right.
How, you know, we've talked a lot about kindness, and your mom especially talked about how, you know, the kids in this series are incredibly unkind, and then, you know, afterwards everybody is all loving and it's a little too late. How have you changed since all this, Katie, in terms of the way that you interact with other people, especially other people who you think might be in pain?
At first, it was really difficult because in the depths of my depression, I thought that was the only thing that defined me. And getting better meant losing that identity. So that made recovery very challenging.
Wow, that's really interesting. That's what you know. It's bad, but it's familiar.
I just didn't know who else I was. So part of the recovery process is committing yourself to building a new identity, even if you don't know what it will look like. So through that, I think even, I don't know, recovery doesn't happen magically. It's something I manage every single day. And through that process, I think I've just become a much more self-confident person. I feel better about my own capacities and my abilities. And I mean, I never thought I would be able to walk across the stage graduating college and, you know, did
with
that.
Honors, yeah, can we just say?
So being, it's, my mental illnesses haven't taken over my life. They're something I deal with, but it's no longer who I am. I'm so much more, and so much more than I ever thought I could be.
All right, let's go back to our listeners. And Amanda's waiting in Londonderry. Hi, Amanda. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling.
I'm curious if a child or teenager were to confide that they were having suicidal thoughts or intent, if there's an optimal response that would at once recognize their current perspective and encourage them to use the resources that will help them.
And is this something you're dealing with in your own life, Amanda, or is this a more general question?
More general.
Okay. All right. Well, go ahead, Kimberly.
So I think the first thing that I do as a psychologist is I try to manage my own emotional responses. This can be pretty hard to hear when somebody's talking about this.
And especially somebody you care about.
Right. And so that's the very first kind of piece of it is be aware of your own responses. I think that the next kind of piece of that is just listen. Try to
understand where they're coming from. A lot of times what I hear from teenagers when they talk about this with me is that people tell them just to get over it, or that
people still say that, really?
Yeah, that it's not that big of a deal, that they can handle it. So just try to listen and kind of understand where they're coming from, and say that I want to understand more about how you're feeling. Make sure that you're providing them resources. Don't leave them alone. If somebody comes to you and says that I'm thinking about killing myself, stay with them until that they get the help and the support that they need. And, you know, as a school psychologist, sometimes that means I'm put in the tough position of saying to a child, this is not something that I can keep secret from your parents. Mm. I have to tell them. And that can be really difficult, but it's really important that you or anybody who's responding this is telling somebody who can get them help. That's very important.
Well, one of the other huge problems that a lot of people like you, Kimberly, had with this series, 13 Reasons Why, is the ineptitude of the school counselor in this show, Mr. Porter. Now, here's Hannah telling him about her suicidal thoughts, and here's his response.
It sounds like there's something that you need that you're not getting. So let's start there.
I need it to stop.
You need what to stop?
I need everything to stop. People, life.
Life?
Okay, and again, school counselors, Kimberly, we're running out of time, but this guy is not portrayed as the way to do it.
Absolutely not.
He also tells her when she talks about her sexual assault, well, you could move on.
Absolutely. It's absolutely not the right thing to do. And I think that none of the school counselors I work with would respond in that way. And so I want to send that message.
Well, I just want to close out with a great email we got from Ginger, who says, for decades, we've put such emphasis on physical health. You are required to have a physical every year for school, sports, camps. Ginger says, imagine what our communities would look like if we also had mental health checkups or well visits, childhood well visits every year. Ginger says, isn't our mental health equally, if maybe not more important, than our physical health? And Ginger, thank you so much for the email. Thanks to everybody who participated, who didn't get on the air. The conversation always continues on our Facebook page and at nhpr.org. And everyone, tough topic. Thank you so much for being here. Katie, congratulations.
Thank you.
On graduating from Syracuse University. And good luck with whatever path you take from here out.
Thank you very
much. Yeah, she's looking for a job now.
We'll talk about that after this show. Sharon, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Kimberly, it was good to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Josh Rogers. Join me tomorrow on The Exchange for the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'll be talking live with other reporters about the week's top headlines, the New Hampshire stories that caught our attention, our state connection to national events, and what we saw this week. What are you thinking about state politics? Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us every Friday morning at 9 and again at 7 p.m. on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.